This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the fourth and last in the series of lectures associated with the UCSB Global Warming Science and Society event series. This series has been built around what I consider the three great pillars that define the issue of global warming: climate change, energy, and societal impact. Our first three lectures, featuring NASA's Jim Hansen discussing dangerous human-made climate change, BP's Steve Coonan addressing energy trends and technology, and New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert discussing her book Field Notes from a Catastrophe, laid a tremendous foundation for the series. Our talk tonight builds on that foundation and leads us to an appropriate final topic, the issue of activism and societal change. Few issues are as challenging in scale and scope and impact as global warming. But when you read author and environmental activist Bill McKibben's writings, you have a sense that these challenges can be met and that a brighter future both for our home planet and for our society lies ahead. I want to again thank UCSB's Arts and Lectures program for their vision in putting on this series, the anonymous community donor Arts and Lectures secured to fund the series, the many departments, programs, and institutes on campus that have contributed to these events, and finally, to all those individuals that have worked so hard and with such dedication, often completely behind the scenes, to make these events a success. I also want to thank our media sponsors, KCLU, Santa Barbara Independent, Cox Media and Cox Communications, and also drivinggreen.com for donating the carbon credits to offset this series. As you will see from your programs, after the lecture there will be a panel discussion that will include Mr. McKibben, UCSB English professor Stephanie Lemonager, UCSB 2006 graduate and Community Environmental Council senior associate Kelly Newman, and myself. To introduce tonight's speaker, I now turn over the podium to an expert on environmental literature, UCSB Professor Stephanie Lemonager, whose name I cannot pronounce, but I'm trying very hard. She's going to correct me now.
Thank you. I wanted to thank David for the opportunity to speak with you tonight and to introduce Bill McKibben. I've been a fan of his for many years. And also I want to thank David for pronouncing my name correctly. That was beautifully done. It was perfect. I was actually introduced to Bill McKibben first through his very first book, The End of Nature, which some of you may know. That was a book published in 1989. And it's widely regarded as the first book to be published for a general audience on the topic of global warming, a book that was initially serialized, too, in the New Yorker magazine. And I teach The End of Nature in my literature and environment class at UC Santa Barbara, in conjunction with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, because I think that these two books hold a unique place and an equal standing, really, in U.S. environmental history and in the strong tradition of American nature writing. For me, both McKibben's The End of Nature and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring are books that emphasize to us the importance of the idea of nature, the fact that this idea has, in fact, pushed us as human beings to do our best, to make our best efforts in philosophy, in religion, and in the arts, among other things. And without this idea as viable, if it becomes, in fact, no longer a viable idea because of the kinds of changes that we're making, even to the atmosphere and the seasonal structure, if the idea of nature is no longer viable, then so many other arts, practices, social theories, possibilities of being human are also no longer viable. This is a book that McKibben wrote again in 1989, and I'm not going to speak only about that, but it's a book that really emphasizes the importance not only of ideas, but the importance of affect, of human feeling, and of how feeling can actually change ideologies and inspire political activism. This is also a book that, like Carson's Silent Spring, I think recognizes the specific utility of apocalyptic rhetoric, the language of the end of the world, the language of revelation, and the ways in which apocalyptic rhetoric can actually not just frighten us, but inspire us to recover fundamental human values. When I came to Bill McKibben, I initially thought of him as, in some ways, picking up an environmental literature tradition, which I see grounded in the Jeremiad, a fierce sort of sermon we trace back to the Puritan tradition. But McKibben's sermons are not really quite as fierce as the Puritan Jeremiads, but they accomplish a similar cultural work, which is the work of goading us, again, to seek better alternatives and to take responsibility for our role in creating the communities that we live in, communities that locally can be models for a more sustainable national future, or a durable future, to use McKibben's own terminology from his recent book, Deep Economy, and let me get the subtitle correct, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. In this recent book, the etymological origins of the words economy and ecology in the Greek root word oikos, meaning household, become kind of a basis for a very wide-ranging discussion of what the economy is really for. In other words, let's think of economy and ecology as two things that are deeply linked, two concepts that are deeply linked, and think about whether or not the economy really is meant to be something that sustains our well-being, or again, our happiness as humans on this planet. I think McKibben's discussion of this is a very powerful one because he finds out, or he informs us in Deep Economy, that what really makes us happy is not, surprisingly enough, filling our homes with stuff. In fact, what makes us happy is a feeling of being involved in a home of some kind, metaphorically or literally. And this takes us back to ecology and to that Greek root, oikos. What makes us happy is feeling as if we have a web of relationship that we're embedded in family, in neighborhood, in community, and in regional environment. I think McKibben is one of the few cultural critics writing today, and I think I'm picking up on David's point here a little bit too, who actually dares to engage in optimism to some degree anyway. And his courage to be at least minimally optimistic reaps a lot of rewards for both himself and for us as his potential readers. I think that the gift of his creativity as a social theorist, as well as the breadth of his scholarship, makes a book like Deep Economy particularly powerful. And given that the book essentially attacks the economic progress narrative that's been the dominant narrative in Western culture since at least the time of the Protestant Reformation, McKibben would have to be a significant scholar to make the argument as good as it is. And I think he comes through very strongly as a historian, as a philosopher, and of course also as an environmentalist. So in conclusion, I'd just like to say how grateful I am that Bill McKibben is here. He's a wonderful writer. He's also an activist, and he's going to be talking to us somewhat tonight about his activism, particularly his involvement in a group that he organized in January of 2007 called Step It Up 07. And this group formed and created the greatest so far mass demonstration against government inaction in regard to global warming that we've seen in the United States. A series of rallies that took place in over 1,400 locations in this country on April 14th, in fact, just a few weeks ago. So McKibben, activist, writer, and as I would say, historian and social theorist, also a person who, though I've only mentioned a couple of his books, has written 10 books, many of them absolutely must for any environmental literature course, and just a wonderful person to have here tonight at UCSB. So with great pleasure, I introduce Bill McKibben to you.
First of all, thank you for that introduction. I must say it's a rare introduction when one learns something about one's own work, but that was very much there, and I'm grateful for it. And I'm also grateful to be here. You know, this is a place that around the country people are suddenly thinking and talking and noticing this university. And it's clearly a place doing important work in all kinds of fields, including this one. It's a real pleasure to get to be here and see it a little bit and be part of that excitement. And especially a pleasure to be coming on the heels of friends of mine, James Hansen and Betsy Colbert, who you've gotten to hear already. Terrific giants in this field, people that I've known for a very long time and worked with, and who have done me the great service in this context of taking care of most of the kind of background and detail and whatever on climate change. So I'm not going to spend an awful lot of time on that today. I want to move on to other things that at first blush may seem, at least in passing, disconnected from this question of global warming, but in another sense, I think, are centrally connected to it and without which we're unlikely to be able to grapple with it in the ways that we need to. Global warming is the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. It's the largest change that we've ever managed to produce in the world. And it's the first civilization-scale challenge that we've come up against. And so to talk about it successfully means talking about more than, though this is a part of the answer, talking about more than a series of technological changes or whatever else. It means talking about the civilization-scale response that will be required to deal with the fix that we've gotten ourselves into. And I'm going to talk about this in two different levels tonight, and one will seem too short-term and the other will seem too long-term to you, but that's just the way it is. And I'm going to start with the short-term, the kind of emergency response to the situation that we find ourselves in, the things I think we need to be doing right at the moment. And I'm going to do it by describing a little bit my kind of odd turn in my work in the last year of becoming much more of a kind of activist and actor in these debates. Now, let me tell you the background. You know, as Stephanie said, I wrote the first book about climate change way back in 1989. So I've had a long time to think about and be kind of worried and despairing and depressed and all of that on these issues. Last summer, for a variety of reasons, I was feeling particularly despairing. I think because we'd finally reached the point where we could no longer really blame our inaction on a lack of knowledge or education about this. Hurricane Katrina had blown open the door. Al Gore had walked through the door with his magnificent slideshow movie. All the polling data showed that Americans understood the situation that we were in. Understood that global warming was a serious problem that we needed to do something about, and yet nothing still was happening. The 20-year bipartisan effort in Washington to accomplish nothing was continuing its unblemished success. And so not being really a very useful activist at all. I mean, you know, I'm a writer. I spend my life in my room, you know. I wasn't quite sure how to respond, what to do, but I felt like finally sort of had to do something. So I called up a couple of friends of mine in Vermont, where I live, including the wonderful environmental writer John Elder, one of my dear friends, and said, look, we've got to do something. Why don't we walk up to Burlington, which is our major city, and we'll sit in on the steps of the federal building, and we'll get arrested maybe. We'll see what happens. Maybe someone will write a story about it. Maybe at least we'll be doing something. And this was the kind of, you know, the sort of level on which I'm afraid tend to operate. And so they were kind and said, okay, we'll come. But one of them happily called up to Burlington to ask the police what would happen if indeed we did this. And the answer was basically nothing. We could sit in at the steps of the federal building pretty much as long as we wanted, and there'd be no response at all. The sort of clear implication was we would need to burn down the federal building, something whose carbon emissions would be prohibitive. So instead, we just kind of organized this walk. We started calling friends, emailing friends, and saying, we're going to walk, come join us. And for 5 days, we left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains, because we liked that poem about the, you know, road less taken, and decided to take it a little bit. And for 5 days, we walked, and we camped in fields at night, and we did programs in churches and things in the evenings. And by the time we got to Burlington, there were 1,000 people marching, which in Vermont is actually a lot of people. This was the biggest demonstration about anything in Vermont in a long time. And it was enough to get all of our candidates for federal office to come meet us, all the people who were running last fall for Senate and for Congress. And we had this rally down on the shores of Lake Champlain, and we held up, we told them we didn't really want to hear them talk about how concerned they were about global warming. We took that for granted. We wanted to hear sort of what they were going to do. And in fact, we wanted to tell them what we wanted them to do. Before they talked, we offered each one the chance to sign this pledge that they would work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which was the kind of minimally scientifically possible goal for doing something about this. And, you know, I confess we sort of stacked the deck by, you know, the as they were standing up to speak and to be, and we were offering them this chance, I had the youngest kid who would march the whole 50 miles with us handing them the Sharpie, you know. They could, you know, so they had to turn him down if they, you know. But all of them signed, okay, including the very conservative people running, the woman who was running on the Republican ticket for Congress, who 2 months before in her announcement speech had said that she wasn't sure that global warming was real and that more research was needed. Well, and this was important for me to realize, in a sense, the more research that was needed turned out to be how many people would walk across the state of Vermont to ask for change. And that's an important lesson, actually, or at least it was for me. And so the only sad note in this whole thing was to pick up the newspaper the next day and read a story that said that these 1,000 people that had assembled might have constituted the largest demonstration about climate change yet held in the United States. And suddenly some of the scales, in a sense, fell from my eyes, and it became a little clearer to me why it was that perhaps so little had happened. You know, we've had for much of that 20 years all the kind of superstructure of a movement. We've had all the scientists who you've met. We've had economists and policy people. We've had journalists writing about it all, and there have been filmmakers and so on. The only part of the movement that's been missing is the movement part, you know, people actually demanding anything. And so we decided to see if we could make this happen outside Vermont, see if it was just a kind of Vermont thing, because Vermont is slightly a weird place, or if it was the same kind of willingness to act all of a sudden could be found nationally. By we, when I say we, I mean me and 6 kids who had graduated from Middlebury in the preceding few months. And we had no money and we had no organization, but we did, you know, this is the 21st century, we did have a website, stepitup07.org. And we launched the website on the 10th of January, urging people to have demonstrations in their communities on April 14th. Now, our secret hope was that we might be able to organize 100 of these rallies, but we didn't tell anyone because it seemed a kind of grandiose hope, given that we had, as I say, no resources. But instead, and only partly because we were doing a good job of organizing, more because there was, I think, a strong desire of Americans to do something, I kept running into people who said, you know, I screwed in the light bulb, but even as I was doing it, I, you know, was thinking this might not actually solve global warming. Perhaps I should do something more, you know. Because of that, by the time April 14th came around, in the course of that 10 weeks, we turned out to have organized 1,400 of these things, you know. And it was incredibly beautiful that evening to watch. Everybody was uploading pictures onto the website where you can see them still and they're worth looking at, to watch these pictures rolling in from all across the country. Now, I'm going to stop telling this story and I'm going to come back to it at the end of this talk, but there's the one thing I want you to keep in the back of your minds because it bears on this longer term thing that I want to talk about now. One of the interesting features about these set of rallies was that they were scattered all across the country, that they were in 1,400 local places, okay? So just keep that in the back of your mind. That's a clue for what I want to get to later. Because now I want to back up and talk about the very long-term implications of what needs to happen, I think. This new book of mine, Deep Economy, tries to take the questions that have been kind of brewing in my mind for two decades and synthesize them into something more systematic. And it really, by the centers on this question, whether or not we can continue to make economic growth the central activity of our society, whether we can and whether we should, whether or not the central default assumption of American society that more is better is a good working assumption any longer. If you have any doubt that it is the default assumption of our society, just go home and turn on the news tonight. The objective and non-biased newscaster will nonetheless, when she gets to the economic news, say something like, "Good news on the economic front today. Gross national product grew 3.6%. And it would never occur to her to say bad news on the, troubling news on the economic front today. Housing starts were up 12% or something like that. Even though at some level, most of us, if we stop to think about it, could begin to think of reasons why, 12% more subdivisions going in where we lived or something wasn't the happiest single piece of news that there might be. Even the words that we use to talk about the economy, to think about it, get at our sort of emotional identification with it, an identification that's far stronger than our identification with the kind of planet itself. Think about it. Things, the economy is ailing, it's suffered a setback, or now it's in recovery, it's flourishing. This sort of tender caress that we offer the economy in pretty much stark contrast to the way that we take completely for granted the physical world of which it is, after all, a subset. Every hour on the hour, you can check the temperature of the economy. You can turn on the radio and the Dow Jones, it'll tell you exactly what the Dow Jones was. We check the temperature of the planet rather less often. And it may turn out that that was a bad ordering of priorities at some point down the line. Now, why is that our default assumption about things? Well, because for quite a while, it worked pretty well. When we lived in a condition of real material privation, okay, then it was understandable that there'd be a lot of momentum built up to acquire the kind of level of comfort and ease and convenience that we enjoy. I've spent a lot of time reading aloud to my daughter, and one of the sets of books that we've read several times with great pleasure are those Laura Ingalls Wilder books, the Little House on the Prairie books. People here have read those, yes, I take it. That kind of American story, of this, people in the frontier living lives very rich in community and in family and very poor materially. Christmas comes and you have, a stick of candy or a penny or maybe a rag doll, and that's that. I was kind of thinking about those stories last year when I was in China doing some reporting for National Geographic and Harper's. And one of the things I was doing was spending a lot of time at factories. And I spent a couple of days at a shower curtain factory north of Beijing. Everybody who worked there was 18 to 22. So pretty much it was like, UCSB, except instead of going to class, people were making shower curtains. It was not Dickensian, as these places go. It was pretty good. And the people there were very clear that it represented a step up for them over the almost impossible lives in a countryside in China that's badly overpopulated and whose soil is so depleted that people trying to support a family on an average holding of about a sixth of an acre come close to starving to death, with each season. So they were, and so I was wandering through the dorms where people lived, and all the girls' dorms where I was, they were okay. There were bunk beds and things. There'd be four people to a room, and all the girls had stuffed animals on their beds, a stuffed animal. So I was making small talk that evening with a young woman that I was trying to interview, and I asked her if she had stuffed animal, just to make small talk, just to kind of loosen her up. And instantly I knew I'd asked the wrong question. Her eyes filled up with tears. She was 19. She said, yeah, she really, really liked stuffed animals. She'd never had one. Every penny that she made went straight home. They were trying to get her brother through school. Her parents were sick. She was it as far as earning in her family. Needless to say, by the end of the day, she had the largest stuffed animal in that corner of China. She was happy to get it. All the other kids in the factory were really happy to see her get it. It was actually quite moving to see how happy they were. But the point that it brought home to me was the vast gulf between that experience and our experience. My daughter likes stuffed animals too. But the biodiversity of Beanie Babies in her bedroom rivals that of the Peruvian Amazon, okay? And the next one counts for very little. As the economist would say, its marginal utility is extremely small. We no longer live in Little House on the Prairie. Okay, we live in Big House on the cul-de-sac. And that should begin to influence how we perceive the world and how we act in it. It should allow us to start asking a different set of questions than people 150 years ago were asking about what they wanted out of their economy. Because there are big problems with having, at this point, more growth, economic expansion as the main point of our all our institutions. One of them, and I'm not going to belabor this point because Jim Hansen and Betsy Colbert and others have made it well, one of them is the incredible ecological peril into which we now fall. Suffice it to say for me tonight only this, that what's changed in 20 years in our understanding of global warming is, A, we're now completely certain about it, and B, we're understanding that it's happening more quickly and on a larger scale than we would have guessed 20 years ago. And the basic physical reason for that is that none of the negative feedbacks, none of the things that we hoped might slow down the escalating temperature have appeared in any significant quantity. And all of the positive feedbacks that we anticipated in the late 80s, plus about six that we hadn't ever thought of, have appeared as well, have appeared, and they are remarkably amping up the progress of this warming. Y'all listened to Jim Hansen the other day, and you were very lucky to get to hear him. He's the more than any other person responsible for the fact that we're even talking about climate change. Not only his science, but also his courage in raising these issues have been exemplary. I've known him for a very long time, and I would say that he went, and over the last 3 or 4 years, from being concerned and worried and working hard to being on the edge of panicking. And I think that you may have heard some of that in his voice when he was here and talked about the fact that his modeling shows we have less than 10 years in order to turn around the flow of carbon into the atmosphere, or else, as he puts it, we face a totally different planet. Now, I could talk to you endlessly tonight about what that totally different planet's going to look like, what its implications are for the rest of creation, what its implications are for the most marginal and poorest two-thirds of the planet, what its implications are for all of our lives. I'm not going to do that. Suffice it to say that for tonight's talk, totally different planet is something that we don't want and we should try to avoid at almost any cost. So that's one problem with this all-out economic expansion. It's, at the moment anyway, and as far as we can tell everywhere around the world, ineluctably tied to more and more and more consumption of fossil fuel. It's extremely difficult to imagine making the kind of change over that 10-year period at the same time that we're trying to maintain 4% and 5% and 6% growth rates in economic expansion around the world. The second problem, less obvious, just as interesting, is this. At the point in which we now live, this big house in the cul-de-sac kind of world, economic expansion turns out not to be making us anywhere near as happy as it claims it should. Okay? The more is better paradigm has begun to break down in very interesting ways. Now, we're only now kind of beginning to even find out about this, because for a long time, it was the question of whether or not people were satisfied with their lives, were happy, was one of the few research areas into which academics were careful not to stray. It was seen as too big an issue or too soft an issue or something like that. And anyway, the economists told us that, in a sense, they had a reasonable proxy for the answer with their concept of utility, that you could tell what made someone happy by what they bought. Okay? Though all of us know at some level that that's a pretty limited answer, it had to suffice because there wasn't a kind of competing explanation or competing idea, because, among other things, people viewed as extremely suspicious the idea that it might be useful to just plain ask people whether or not they were happy. 8, 9, 10 years ago, a number of social scientists began looking at that question harder, trying to figure out if it was a useful question to ask. Okay? And many of these were economists, including people like the Princeton scholar Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel in economics 3 or 4 years ago. Being economists, of course, they began trying to figure out whether or not people's answers were reliable in the most grim and dismal and unhappy ways. One of the early studies that Kahneman talks about in his book, Hedonics, involved interrupting people undergoing colonoscopies every 10 seconds to ask them how they were feeling, you know, more or less. Through a very long, you know, the sort of the mountain of papers that were soon beginning to flood in, trying to assess sort of all the, after about 5 years, people reached a pretty strong consensus that in fact there was, this was quite, that subjective well-being was in fact a robust phenomenon that you could talk about, that it made sense, that people's answers to that question correlated pretty well with how other people observed them, with certain things in brain chemistry that you could measure, with a number of other objective. It gave academics the sort of courage to begin asking that question or to look at the data that there was around about that question, which is not extensive but interesting. For instance, one of the national polling firms, every year since the end of World War II, has asked Americans, are you happy? And you can answer, I'm very happy, happy, not happy. This must be a kind of odd phone call to get right before dinner, you know, asking you this, but the sample is pretty interesting. The number of Americans who say that they're very happy, their lives, peaks in 1956 and goes slowly but steadily downhill ever since. Not much more than a quarter of Americans will make that claim at the moment. That downward curve is interesting. And it's interesting to me because I was born in 1960, so I missed whatever was going on in 1956. I'll never know. But what's really interesting about it is that in that same 50-year period, the curve of our possessions, our material standard of living, the amount of stuff we have, has gone in exactly the opposite direction. We have about 3 times the material standard of living per capita that we did in the mid-50s. We have much huger houses, many more cars, far more appliances. We take many more trips. If our sense, our intuitive sense about the economy was correct, those two curves should go in someplace the same direction. Yes, they should bear some relation to each other. The fact that they diverge, you know, that they not only don't go in the same direction, but that they split apart like that, is a pretty interesting question. And there are many more measures to indicate that, in fact, Americans are not very happy with their lives and growing steadily less so. We don't have unbelievable amounts of data about why this is. But the data we do have is, again, interesting and suggestive. And the direction that it points is this, that those two, those diverging curves are not just coincidental, that there's something about that rising affluence that's triggering some of that dissatisfaction. And the thing that seems to be triggering it is a deep sense among Americans of a dwindling social connection, of an accelerating loss of community. Think about what we spent our money on beginning in the 1950s. More than anything else, it was building ever bigger houses ever further out in the suburbs, okay? Mathematically reducing the chances that in the course of a day we were going to run into each other, okay? It's no surprise that the average American has something like half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. That the amount of time that we spend eating meals with friends, family, neighbors has been cut by more than half. Okay? And it turns out that those things count. That they count more than the fact that we have 3 times as many square feet or 8 times as many appliances or whatever else. It was a bad bargain. We went past a point that we probably shouldn't have gone. But it's very difficult once this gets going to break out of it. Because what we've done as we've become more and more affluent is create a kind of hyper-individualized human that our species hasn't really ever seen before. I mean, that's been the dynamic at work. Ever more and more of this hyper-individualistic sense of who we are. Reaching the point now where farce and tragedy are almost meeting. There was a story in the New York Times 3 weeks ago about the new trends in upscale architecture. And I always kind of wonder when I see the enormous houses that people are building, the sort of houses that look like kind of little junior high schools, you know, popping up on the hill, what exactly it is that people, it goes on in these places. Well, one of the apparently the new trend, and quite widespread, is for dual master bedrooms, okay? You may have seen this story in the Times. Husbands and wives increasingly find it difficult to share a bedroom. One of them snores, one of them, you know, pulls the blankets off. The American solution to this problem is to add 900 square feet to the house, you know? And it's incredibly sad on two levels. One, it's incredibly sad because if you've spent any time in the rest of the world, you know that most places, if people are lucky enough to have a bed at all, there's 4 or 5 people sharing it, and nobody's worrying about who's snoring. But it's also just sad for what it says about the kind of increasing and essential loneliness of the society that we're building, you know? Happily, it seems to me, at least to some degree, the solutions to these various problems lie in somewhat the same direction. Not in preaching a lot about how good community would be, but about beginning the task of building stronger local economies that will perform the dual tasks of reducing the amount of energy that we're using running our lives and bringing us back in contact with each other some. Let me give just a couple of examples. Let's start with food, because it's where the most work has been done. We've allowed our food system to become incredibly globalized in the last 50 years, as you know. The average bite of food in this country travels 2,000 miles before it reaches your lips. We order takeout from 2,000 miles away at every meal. Our system operates on the assumption that since it's always summer someplace, that's where we should be eating. The energy cost of that is enormous. You know, where I live, back east, if I want to eat lettuce this time of year, it comes from that far from here, which means that it takes, you know, 36 calories of fossil energy to get 1 calorie of that lettuce back east to me. That's a poor ratio if you're concerned about things like global warming. It's also, it turns out, a poor ratio if you're concerned about things like good-tasting food, you know? I mean, I've traveled 2,000 miles to get here. I know how I feel. That's pretty much how the strawberry feels, you know, by the time it gets to where you're going. So you can do a lot, sort of energy-wise, to deal with this. And by some estimates, food alone accounts for 30-35% of global carbon emissions. The food system. But you also can do a lot. I mean, here's the good news. The fastest growing part of our food economy in this country is farmers markets. Sales are growing 10 or 12% a year. That's good news for those energy reasons, but it's also good news for these other reasons about our kind of disconnection. A couple of years ago, a pair of sociologists followed shoppers, first through the supermarket, then to the farmers market. Y'all been to the supermarket, you know how it works. You walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance, you visit the stations of the cross around the corners of the supermarket, you emerge somehow with exactly the same basket full of items that you had all the previous weeks, and you have the kind of fascinating credit or debit conversation at the checkout counter, maybe paper or plastic, depending. When they followed people around the farmer's market, they had 10 times as many conversations in the course of a visit. Now, a lot of you are social scientists. You know that you're used to sort of measuring things that, you know, it is 0.18% increase in something statistically significant. I mean, they had 10 times more conversations. This was not just like a different way of getting calories. It was a whole other experience rooted in some other way of being human, all right? You can do the same argument for almost any commodity that you name. Just in the same way that we think that calories come through Del Monte and Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, we think that BTUs and electrons need to come through ExxonMobil and through Peabody Coal and whoever else. But in fact, it's possible to imagine an energy system that works much more like a farmer's market, with people putting in and taking out. I have solar panels on my roof. When the sun comes out, I'm firing electrons down the grid. My neighbor's refrigerator is running off the sunlight falling on my shingles. Cloud goes over, I suck in power from somebody else. If you think about that over the long term, it's a hell of a lot more durable. It's not only more ecologically benign, it's a hell of a lot more durable than our present energy system, which is largely dependent on things like convincing the people of the southern Appalachians to keep blowing the tops off their mountains so we can get at their cheap coal, or trying to manipulate the politics of distant Middle Eastern countries where it becomes more apparent with each passing day that we haven't a clue, you know? This is a much, I think, more benign in many ways, a vision. Even very ephemeral commodities, you know, that have very little energy impact but are still interesting to think about. You can make the same argument for things like culture and arts and, say, music. We've come to think of music as something that's produced in Hollywood or Nashville and arrives at our home in a hard-to-open plastic box, you know. And the people who run that industry tell us, over and over again, that if we do naughty things like illegally download these songs, then, you know, not only will they lose a lot of money, but there will be, you know, they say there'll be no more incentive for artists to create new songs, and hence there'll be no more music. Every human culture that there's ever been has produced music. In fact, we're the sort of anomalous ones for figuring out how to just have a very few specialists producing it instead. We could figure out, and we are figuring out, many other ways to do this. Here's an interesting statistic that I came across in the course of this book that lodged in my head. In 1900, in the state of Iowa alone, there were 1,300 opera houses, okay? 1,300 live music venues. Now, nobody in them was getting Whitney Houston rich singing, okay? And nobody who went to them was hearing the best singer in the world the way that we can, you know, if by buying the CD. On the other hand, all the people there were hearing music in some context, some social context with their neighbors that added a good deal to it, maybe a good deal more than the kind of white earbudded cocoon in which we increasingly experience these things. It doesn't surprise me that the fastest growing part of the music economy is, in fact, live performance and traveling bands or jam bands and things, the kind of modern equivalent of the minstrels or bards of yore. I think that we should spend much of this century trying to reel in some of the supply lines that we spent the last century flinging ever further out. And I think if we do, we'll end up here and around the world in a sounder place than otherwise. Plan A, that everyone's going to be like us, middle-class Americans, isn't going to happen. Okay? I mean, just look at China alone. It's currently growing at 10% a year. If that continues for another 30 years, the Chinese will be as rich as we are per capita. Should the Chinese choose to consume the way we do, the 800 million cars on the planet currently would be joined by another 1.1 billion in China. And, you know, beyond that, India and everybody else who's lined up behind them. If the Chinese ate our diet, the Chinese alone would consume two-thirds of the world's grain harvest. These sort of things aren't possible, okay? But the only option to preventing the sort of attempt to get there is for us to begin thinking about much more creative ways in which to live out our lives. And I think that this idea of localness may be one of the important ones. Which brings me back to where I started with a description of these global warming rallies that we did this year. Now, when we started, all the people who actually knew what they were doing said, no, no, you want to do a march on Washington. That's how these things are done. Okay? Well, we didn't want to do a march on Washington because, A, we didn't have any money or organization, and we had, you know, we knew that this was beyond us. You know, you want to do a march on Washington, somehow you have to rent 2,000 portable toilets, you know, and line them all. I have no idea how to do that. No desire to find out. We also thought there was something sort of incongruous about the idea of, you know, sending hundreds of thousands of people crossing the continent spewing carbon behind them in order to have an anti-global warming demonstration. And we also thought that Congress people would pay a lot more attention to people in their own districts when if they realized that these were their constituents who were worried about this. Most of all, we wanted people to be able to take these stands in the places where they were, in the places that mattered to them, able to demonstrate against the backdrops of their lives and their dreams and their hopes and their fears what it was that they wanted done. And it was incredibly beautiful to see that happen, to see the kind of native genius of people in their own places expressed in this political action. Down in the Florida Keys, there were all these scuba divers who got together and did an underwater demonstration. They took our banner, 80% by, said, step it up, Congress, cut carbon 80% by 2050. And they took it underwater off those coral reefs that aren't going to be there in 50 years if the water keeps warming. There's video of it on our website. It's beautiful. A little further up the coast in Jacksonville, all these people from the hunting and angling community and others got together and they rented a crane and they lifted a yacht 20 feet into the air to show where the sea level would be if Greenland slides into the ocean, you know. In Manhattan, thousands of people crowded into Lower Manhattan down on the Battery wearing blue shirts to form a kind of sea of people to show where the tide line will start to come now in Lower Manhattan. If the sea rises, it was incredibly beautiful. You know, in the Rockies, in the Sierras, there were groups of people who did these long, arduous 3- and 4-day ascents of these backcountry glacial mountains. The glaciers are disappearing. They skied in formation down these dwindling glaciers. You know, it was every kind of creative response and every kind of person. I knew we needed more than environmentalists to make it happen. And I knew that it was going to be a success a week or two into this thing when we got a group of students who had sort of jumped the gun and held their rally early. And it was a group of young women from the Alpha Phi sorority chapter at the University of Texas at Austin. And they looked just the way you would expect, sort of Texas sorority girls. I mean, they had huge smiles, you know. They couldn't have... But there were like 180 of them holding up this stuff sign. And they wrote a little note to us when they sent it in. We wanted to show it wasn't just the hippies who cared, you know? which I thought was so sweet because You know, basically it is hippies. It's those of us who think a little off-center about the world that tend to start things, you know. But it's sorority chapters and evangelical churches and League of Women Voters chapters and everybody else who kind of tends to finish things off, or at least to move them into the mainstream where the political system has no choice but to deal with it. Doing it this way over the web reminded me, too, that we have a sort of certain luxury in thinking about the future and about a more local future that people before us really didn't. I mean, there really was a long time when, at some level, people had to make a choice about whether they were going to stay in a tight local community or they were going to go out into the larger world and be a part of that and make their fortune or their fame or whatever it was. We live in a world, all of a sudden, where thanks to these technologies, it's possible to imagine really tight local community lives with tight local economies. And at the same time, always a window open to sort of blow in new ideas and blow out some old prejudices to share kind of best practices about things. I'm no technological utopian by any means, but the power of the web was amply demonstrated to me in the course of this winter. There is no way that we could have done this work in the way that we were doing it without those technologies. And the possibilities for some of that are extremely interesting. I'm no reflexive optimist, Pollyanna, about any of this, okay? I mean, I wrote a book called The End of Nature, all right? But I do think that there are possibilities both in the short run and the long run for figuring out how to grapple with this biggest of problems. In the short run, it takes an all-out political movement. It takes a political movement as morally urgent, as committed, as passionate, as willing to sacrifice as the civil rights movement was a generation ago. Nothing short of that will do. In the long run, it takes a willingness to think about more deeply about the architecture of our lives and to recognize that we've come to one of those forks in human history where it's no longer possible to just keep doing exactly straight ahead what we assumed we'd be doing. Okay? Where we need to think differently. Where we need to break out of some of our current divisions. One of the very nice things, and here I will end, one of the very nice things about these local economies that I've been describing is that it's not at all clear whether they're a liberal or a conservative idea. Not at all clear whether a farmer's market is liberal or conservative. It's some of each, but it's also repugnant to certain parts of each of those political philosophies. My friend in Vermont, a guy named Todd Murphy, who founded this thing called the Farmer's Diner, it's a diner. It serves food at diner prices, you know, ham and eggs, $4.99, whatever. But all the food comes from within about 50 miles of the kitchen. He's really worked hard to kind of rebuild this local food system. When he was starting up, he printed up a bunch of bumper stickers that I really liked, and they said, "Think globally, act neighborly." It strikes me that that's probably a fairly eloquent thing to do when we're thinking about carbon and the atmospheric concentration of it and the increase in temperature and all the other things that we'd be wise to think about. And so it's a pleasure to be in a place where those conversations have obviously begun and are being taken seriously. Thank you.
For those of you who've attended these before, what we have been doing is we've been having the lectures, and then basically the idea of the panel is really more to have a discussion. And to facilitate that, I've invited two new folks to join us. Stephanie, I'm always afraid to say your last name.
Lemonager.
And Stephanie, of course, made a beautiful, really moving introduction of Bill, and she's a associate professor in our English department and an expert in environmental literature, and I thought it would be just very interesting to have that perspective as part of this panel. And then we have Kelly Newman. Her name I can pronounce quite well. And Kelly, I really wanted to have a student perspective on this panel. I hope we have some students out there. I can't tell. The students in my class were supposed to come to get extra credit, so hopefully that, I don't know if that worked. If you're out there, good. And I wanted to have a student perspective because of what Bill has done working with students at Middlebury College, and in particular the issue of activism. At the end of the Colbert lecture, someone said to me, so where are the students? Are they inspired by this? Do they care about this? Do they want to see change on this issue? And so I'm going to put that on your shoulders, Kelly. You're going to get to represent that. Kelly graduated from UCSB just last year, and she's now working at the Community Environmental Council, and they're very progressive and important programs looking at the issue of energy change and fossil-free by 33. I'm sure you'll tell us about that. But I'm going to start with Bill. I'm going to start with a really easy question. Bill, I think you can answer the hard ones, but I'll start with an easy one. I'm interested, you mentioned, of course, that you've been writing about this and thinking about this issue for, 20 years now, right? And that's, you know, perhaps longer than, I mean, certainly other scientists, but longer than many writers and analyzers of the scene. So I'm interested in if you could just tell us a little bit about how you've seen the public reaction and opinion change to this issue. How has that changed the words you write, the things you say, and how, you know, what does it make you think about how opinion is changing?
It's clear that the last 2 years represent a big, sharp break with all that's gone before. The previous time in front of that, I mean, I spent a lot of time out talking and speaking and writing and things, but there was no way to gain really much traction on these questions politically. And what I always said to people, and I think it was correct, you know, is that's all right. We can't. There's no political opening at the moment, which means that those of us who care about this have to do the hard work of building the networks, getting the ideas, doing it, so that when the moment comes, we'll be able to take full advantage of it. The moment took longer to come than I thought it would. It came in the rest of the world long ago, 10 years ago, and across the rest of the developed world. But, you know, for a variety of reasons, many of them having to do with ExxonMobil, it took a lot longer here than it did elsewhere. But now there is this opening, and the polling data is very suggestive of how big those changes have been in very rapid order. There was a Gallup poll the other day showing that 44% of Americans want to ban cars that get less than 30 miles to the gallon, okay, which, given the sort of profile of American cars, means that, you know, half of those people wanted to ban their own automobile, all right? That's, you know, that... Even 6 months ago, that number would have been less than half that, I think. Changes, but the problem now is figuring out how to turn that changed sentiment into actual action quickly that counts for something. And it's not at all clear that that's going to happen. I was telling people at dinner about the, you know, testifying on Capitol Hill about 10 days ago, and really being forced to remember again and again how unbelievably out of touch much of Capitol Hill is, less than before the last election, but still, I mean, there are an extraordinary number of people there who continue to believe that, at least in the United States, physics and chemistry are kind of optional. They're sort of malleable the same way that the tax code or something is, and it's going to be hard to get real big change, the kind that we need.
Just to focus in specifically on the writing, what prompted, I mean, 19, you must have started writing The End of Nature in, I'm guessing, 1987, 88.
Yeah,
I mean, that was pretty early. I mean, you know, the Vostok CO2 curves were published about that time. That was actually, I was in graduate school and started to get interested in the issue at that time myself. What prompted you to choose the topic of global warming?
Well, you know, partly because I'm a reporter by background, and this was a good story, and no one else was telling it, and, you know, I was sort of reading the early science, but just as much because I was reading it in the context of the place where I lived. I was living in the place I loved most in the world, in the mountains of upstate New York, right. The Adirondacks, the one great eastern wilderness, and, you know, I was completely, desperately in love with that place, which is the greatest example of nature conservation anywhere in the world. I mean, the only place in the world that's come back on that scale over 100 years. And to sort of be faced with the fact that all that incredible effort to make that place in many ways truly wild again was about to go for naught because of this sort of uncontrollable large force. I mean, it made me, the dominant emotion of the end of nature was not fear, but sadness about things. Which I, you know, in some ways I think is also the dominant emotion of Silent Spring, I would say, is less sort of, I mean, you know, Rachel Carson was already dying of cancer. I mean, you know, whatever. It was sadness about what was happening to the world around her.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of fierce despair, though, that in its very ferocity is inspiring, you know. And I find you so powerful as a maker of symbolic intensity, which I think is what we need. And I found myself a bit saddened when I heard you talking at the very beginning of your lecture, which is a beautiful lecture, about how you and John Elder kind of sat down and said, how can we do something? And you made some comment about how we were writers, but we were, you know, as if writing and doing something were vastly different. And as a literature professor, I was just, my heart was breaking at that moment. So I guess I was wondering if you could maybe speak a little bit about, you know, given that this moment is a moment of crisis, I mean, I think many of us agree on that, what is the role now of the writing?
Well, for me, I mean, in fact, one of the interesting things about the last, I mean, I was sort of, you know, to make any of these, to make something like this act, this sort of set of rallies we were doing, you need a kind of narrative, right? And our narrative was, like, we're a bunch of bumbling idiots who have no idea what we're doing, and hence, look, you know, you guys have to do it. I mean, actually, we were quite good at organizing these things, I must say. And one of the reasons that it worked, actually, is because, in a weird way, we live in a very, all of a sudden, a very word-intensive, you know, the most important writing I've done this year was the original email that I wrote that I started that virally spread around the country in a month or so, and it was a good piece of writing, it's very odd how the web is a text-based medium that requires, or that allow, you know, if, you know, good writing works just as well on there as, in fact, may work better on there because it's up against a backdrop of a lot of not very good writing. And so, you know, that was certainly part of it.
Yesterday, actually, here in Corwin, they had a conference, Media and the Environment, and it was fascinating to hear some of the different perspectives on the way media is treating the environment and the way people are viewing nature and the role of the media in tackling in climate change and a lot of these issues today. And it really, I think I just walked away with such an impression of how important it is for this to stay a mainstream focus in the media that everyone is impacted by every single day. And so hearing you talk about, you know, there is such a role for writers, I think that's so true. And not just for writers, but for bloggers and people who are making, you know, films and documentaries, because I don't think that this is going to, we're really going to see change on this issue if it falls out of the media in the course of the next year.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, Stephanie and I, in preparing this week for this, we're talking about contrasting inconvenient truth, of course, to the kind of writing you and Elizabeth Colbert and others do. And I mean, I think both our impressions are that, and probably most folks, the inconvenient truth had a tremendous impact. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to not say it probably reached more people than perhaps anything else. But it's a very different kind of impact than a book. I don't know. Maybe you want to.
I can only give my sort of anecdotal testimony as a person who ended up showing an inconvenient truth in her class because my last book for the quarter didn't come in on time. So I ended up showing the Gore Guggenheim film. And I was really surprised, but also I think I learned from the fact that many of my students said this is where I finally got it. And not just because the science started to make sense, but also that moment when Gore points to a pixel and he says, this is our globe. I think about a phrase that Wallace Stegner used. I think he called it the fragility of goodness. Our love of the land is wrapped up in this idea of its fragility. And I think seeing the smallness of that globe, getting a visceral sense of it, was very important for the students. And it seemed like that visual image, and all of the visual images actually in that film, carried a lot of power. That some of the literature we read, which I personally was much more moved by and found much more interesting in its analyses, didn't quite seem to deliver.
You know, visual images, I mean, have been... I mean, before the first Earth Day, okay, the important visual image was that view of the Earth
right.
from Apollo 8 or whatever it was. You know, this first glimpse of this, you know, marble floating through space, and you know, and it did have a big impact. But in an odd way, the sad part was how limited, in the long run, that impact turned out mm-hmm. to be. You know, it was quite possible for us to sort of put that out of our minds because, you know, basically the 30 years since that first Earth Day, or 35, has been devoted to consuming things,
right.
not to sort of acting on that vision of whatever. You know, those images and any set of words and anything are... We need to figure out also how to incarnate them in the sets of institutions that can do something. There's a great danger in any... In sort of sentiment unmoored from anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a weird, but this is an odd way to get at this, but one of the things that we went out of our way to do in the course of these Step It Up things that we were doing was to not involve celebrities mm-hmm. in the course of doing it.
Right.
In fact, for some reason, when we got the picture from Saratoga Springs, New York that night, they were very pleased because a couple of celebrities had happened to be in town for some reason, Daryl Hannah and somebody else, and they had them right down front and things. And so we just put the picture up but didn't sort of mention yet, and I don't know if anybody even noticed. What was important for us was the idea that these were that in fact we were all very ordinary, and that this was, and I don't know quite why that seemed so important to us, but I mistrust that sentiment unconnected to actual things. That's why for me things like farmers markets are so great. They wouldn't have happened without, at least in their current volume, without some of those sort of words and images. You know, Wendell Berry and Michael Pollan gave rise to much of that. Wendell Berry for 30 years sort of preaching this gospel. But until people actually went out and did the work of, you know, getting the permit and rounding up the farmers and telling everybody and cleaning up the trash at the end of the day and everything, they didn't amount to anything more than that. Mm-hmm. You know?
You know, well, we've gotten to the issue of Step It Up, and so let's talk about that a little bit. I just wanted to share with the audience my own experience. I was asked to speak at a rally in Thousand Oaks. There were about 75 people that attended. I mean, obviously, you couldn't attend all those full 1,400, so maybe these anecdotes are useful at some level. And I spoke, and there was also an environmental lawyer, a former lawyer at EPA, who spoke. And I've already told Bill this anecdote, but what stays in my head about this event was at the end of it, the person who had organized it stood up and he said, I want to tell you why I'm doing this. And he said, come here. And he called up his son. And he put his arm around his son and he said, and he started crying. And he said, you know, this is why I'm doing this. It's because I want my son to have, you know, the same opportunities that I've had. And so, you know, that there was a real, it was almost like a Rachel Carson moment. There was that real mm-hmm. visceral connection.
All of us doing this work, I think, from many different directions, are looking for what the next metaphor is. Okay, mm-hmm. That's what those images are about, and it's what the for language is about and things. I mean, the old set of metaphors, even the old set of environmental metaphors, are mostly out of steam, out of gas now. They no longer, they're not, you know, it's impossible to ask the same kind of set of ideas that were first called into play to protect Yosemite, you know, yeah. or to whatever, to carry the weight of having to restructure the American economy. It's not fair to demand that the, you know, NRDC and the Sierra Club do the heavy lifting on Capitol Hill, and it's not fair to ask that the sort of grammar of wildness that John Muir evolved, you know, in Tolmie Meadows be the only vessel that, you know, has to deal with this. And that's what a lot of this talk about, for me, about local economies and things is about, is an attempt to figure out what the next set of metaphors, the next set of pictures in our heads that might allow us to make some of these leaps will be like.
Mm-hmm. So when you were organizing Step It Up, did you enlist any of the traditional environmental organizations?
Yeah. And in fact, it went really well, despite their sort of idea that people have that they're, you know, big and remote and only interested in raising money and whatever else. They were, in fact, just as excited as everybody else by the sudden idea that it was like you could just go do this, you know. I mean, they're very big and, it's sort of hard for them to act easily, you know. And so it was much easier for them to sort of act in response to this ad hoc, short-term, you know, thing that we were organizing. You know, that we were sort of making this call. It wasn't even really like organizing. It was like having a potluck supper, you know?
Right.
So we'll try to provide the plates and the cups. You all better bring the stuff, you know? Everybody did.
And obviously, if you look at, you know, and I studied the website and looked at the pictures and, you know, as I said, participated in that one event, it was a great success. But I want to ask you the tough question. Do you think, I mean, is it a model for the future? In other words, and I'd also like to get Kelly in just to talk about students and what's going to inspire them. And we are going to take audience questions, by the way. And I'd love to hear from some students on this. I mean, is this going to do it? Is it going to inspire people? Is it going to move us towards the goals we need?
It's only one thing, you know. I mean, any movement is I mean, we look back, we look backwards at social movements, and we just remember, you know, if you ask people, what was the Civil Rights Movement about? They're like, oh, yeah, that, you know, that Martin Luther King gave that talk, you know, in Washington, and then everybody, you know, they passed the Voting Rights Act, and, you know, I guess something happened in Selma, too, or something, you know. But, I mean, the sort of hundreds of thousands of people doing incredibly brave and interesting things of all different kinds for 30 years are kind of swept up in those few set of images. It's going to take all kinds of stuff. You know, and in this movement, in the climate change movement, it's going to take immense amounts of work of all kinds on campuses because we need, you know, we're talking about things that we don't know how to do. Some of those things are engineering and things, and I'm reasonably confident that people will do that kind of work. Just as important, I mean, God, we need the work of, say, economists to help us figure, if we really are serious someday about building an economy, a society that doesn't have an ever-expanding economy, that's going to take every bit of the brain power of the smartest economists in the world to figure out how to make that happen without it meaning recession and misery and whatever along the way. We need every kind of thing to happen. And unfortunately, when I'm pessimistic, the only reason is this. Unlike the Civil Rights Movement or unlike any other movement that I can think of, this one is a time test, you know? You don't get to, if you don't do it soon, then don't bother doing it, you know? And that makes it all the harder and all the more inconvenient. And I wish to hell that I hadn't, in a certain way, spent the last year doing this, because my daughter's like 14, and all I really want to do is be at home and hanging out with her. But, you know, that's inconvenient, and there's a lot that's inconvenient about having to do things quickly, but that's what we got to do now.
Yeah, and that's of course, the reality of having postponed for so long,
exactly.
Actually taking it in action. But back to the issue of activism, you were telling us, I think, at dinner that the students at Middlebury are really inspired about this issue, and they're working on it. Kelly, do you want to talk about your experiences here and how you see that issue playing out in our campus and other campuses in California?
Definitely. It's like you said, I graduated about a year ago, and I've stayed in Santa Barbara, and I'm working for the Community Environmental Council now. And so I think that I just wanted to preface with that, because I know that some of what I'm going to discuss has been a little bit altered, because now I've had the experience of being a student and seeing what it's like as a student activist, but also moving now into an environmental nonprofit organization and comparing those differences. I think there are huge opportunities for students to really get active on this issue, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. But it's also something to keep in mind that it's really building now. I don't feel like when I was a student, especially, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, that it was a frontline issue. It wasn't, in fact, at least here. I mean, sustainability, going organic, it's a lot of the similar issues, mm-hmm. but I think that what really needs to shift now in the student perspective is actually looking at all of the environmental issues through the lens of climate change, and really saying climate change is the thing that we're looking at all of these issues with, because they all, you know, work together. And, you know, supporting sustainability, supporting organic food, supporting, you know, acting locally and living simply, it all helps climate change so much. But what I would really, and I was wanting to look at how many students were in here, because I almost wanted to just throw it out as a challenge and saying, you know, there's so much going on and recycling is still going to be so important. But I think that there is a shift that needs to happen, even in the student mindset, to say, okay, we are still going to be working on all of these incredible issues that we've been working on for so long, but now we're going to be thinking about climate change as the frontline issue. But and that's to say there's so much going on, even at UCSB right now. Just in March, they signed the President's Climate Commitment, and they are working now on a plan in the next year to become climate neutral, a climate neutrality plan. And there are so many organizations here on campus that have been working on that. Environmental Affairs Board is one of the greatest environmental, you know, groups here on campus that's done so much. CalPERG was really involved with that. CSSC, which is California Student Sustainability Coalition, has been really involved. Energy Action was really involved. Campus Climate Challenge is one that Bill's worked with and mentioned. There's a lot of things that are already happening, and I think it is just about unifying a lot of those movements that are happening, and also about giving students projects that they can do on a student timeline. Because I think there's a lot happening, but I'm also realistic, and I lived in IV for 4 years and, you know, saw the party scene out there and took part in it.
Don't mention that
to me. But it's something that has to happen with still something that's realistic for students. You know, we're great at demonstrations and rallies and parties. Like, that's, I think that it, you know, a lot could be channeled in that means of getting students together out in the open demonstrating for something. But it's
interesting you mentioned that what you saw as a continuum between all the environmental issues, sustainability, traditional environmental issues, preservation, and global warming. It's my opinion that global warming is, I put it in somewhat of a different class, because I think kind of the main impetus for action is really the impact it's going to have on our society. At least that's, you know, that's how I frame it to people. And so if it's only those students that have traditionally been environmentally active that are also active mm-hmm. on global warming, I don't think that's going to be enough. And so I'm wondering, do you have, maybe Bill can also weigh in on this, or maybe Stephanie too, do you have a sense of what it will take to get those other students for whom kind of the bread and butter environmental issues have not been the main motivator, to get them involved in this?
Well, I'm going to throw a plug here for Adam Green at Santa Barbara City College, because they just launched their Sustainability Center over there just in the past couple weeks, actually. And I went to an event last Tuesday, and it was one of the most motivating speeches I've heard in a while. And it was just from someone local. And really what they are trying to do at Santa Barbara City College is make sustainability something that totally integrates all of the departments over there, and not something that's just, you know, the Sustainability Center or, you know, here's the Environmental Studies program separate from the, you know, English department. They said that they are really going to incorporate it everywhere. And that's something that's, there's actually a survey here at UCSB that's being done right now by the Sustainability Department too, to go out and ask teachers and to ask, you know, look into the classes, into the curriculum, and say, what are we already teaching that has a sustainability focus, and have we been thinking about it as a sustainability focus, or have we just been kind of doing it thus far? And what can we do to really make it so that every economics class is not just looking at the GDP, but it's reading, you know, snippets of deep economy now and thinking, are there perspectives here that we need to make sure that every student who graduates from this college has had some impact of green, of climate change, and so they leave with that perspective that it's not a separate discipline. It's actually something that should be incorporated.
And integral to everything. Stephanie made a remark to me, I hope you don't mind my repeating
it. No, that's fine.
That was, again, just in talking about this visit, Bill's visit, I thought that was fascinating what you said, that some of your students, I can't remember the context exactly, had remarked to you they don't want to be made to feel guilty about this issue.
Yeah,
maybe you can tell
the
story.
I was actually going to ask a cranky question, and not to express any kind of disagreement with what you're saying, which I think is wonderful, but I mean, one thing that I've noticed, because I have my students write environmental autobiographies where they talk about how their environmental values and practices were formed and how it relates to where they're from. And it seems like, you know, a lot of the environmental literature that we read seems to come either from Vermont or to somehow relate to Vermont, as in one of the last chapters of Elizabeth Colbert's book about Burlington, Vermont. And we in Southern California are often posed as the anti-Vermont various ways. And I think a lot of the problem is our car culture, you know, which has to do with, I mean, infrastructure, and it has to do with a lot of things. But, you know, this car culture that particularly, I think, has a libidinal appeal to younger folks. I'm not saying I'm immune myself, but it seems to drag on the enthusiasm for other kinds of environmental issues or for the larger challenge posed by global warming. And what I've found with my students is they'll say, well, I'm willing to do X, Y, and Z, but I'm not willing to give up my SUV, you know, and I'm not willing because my SUV is sexy, you know, or it's manly or whatever. And there's just an amazing libidinal draw, again, that's connected to this kind of car culture that we've created and exported through our films and everything else all over the world. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you see some challenges in our particular regional culture here in Southern California to the rise of a significant student movement.
Well, I guess I would put that back on, and I know it's obviously taking a student perspective, but I don't think it's just students.
Yeah, no, I agree. It definitely isn't just students.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I would
that's
say
a
that that's
point.
Probably the general Southern California population that is attached to their car.
Yeah.
So what can we do for students? Well, IV, I mean, more people bike in IV than anywhere else in Southern California, probably. Mm-hmm. There are so many bikes here, it's incredible.
I've always heard that this is a great biking town.
Yeah, it is.
And ways to, like, really celebrate that are, you know, should be in order. I mean, to sort of make that the absolute, you know, to give that the prominence and the honor that it deserves would be a really good thing. The celebration of things that are going right and making us all feel good about the things that we have the right to feel good about, because there are not that many of them,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
are remarkably good good places to start, and probably easier to start than condemning us for, you know, because it is, for, I mean, it's very hard. We never should underestimate the difficulty of breaking out of both the physical structures and the mindsets
exactly.
into which we've fallen. And that, you know, you were asking about the work of writers before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think that the work of educators, too. I mean, the only real interesting job, I think, of education, and it's exactly the reverse of what everyone else thinks, but that's often my case. The only real work of education is to be slightly subversive, you know, to make people doubt some of the ideas that they arrived here attached to. It's mm-hmm. not to give them a whole, you know, new set of ideas to go out and make some more money with or whatever. It's just to make them doubt whether they're actually, things are quite as obvious as they thought they were. And one of the best ways to do that is to sort of, you know, celebrate the people who are, like, riding bikes and, you know,
right.
almost by implication, you know, laugh a little bit at the people who feel the need to be riding around Southern California in vehicles designed for, you know, forest rangers. I tend to think that the technologies that we're missing aren't, you know, are the basic technology that we're missing is the technology of community. And that's what we've allowed to fall into disrepair. And I think that it's more important than the set of technologies that we're at work on. Just to give you a sort of number to stick with that, you know, probably a lot of you in this room have been to Western Europe sometime in the last 10 or 15 years, right? So you know that people there live perfectly decent lives. In fact, when you want to go see the good life, you're somewhat more likely to head for Paris than Phoenix or something. What's interesting about that is the average Western European uses half as much energy as the average American. Half. Half's a big number. It's like way more than we're going to get from ethanol and hydrogen and all the other things that we chatter about. And it's mostly because they've just chosen a little differently on this scale between community and hyper-individualism. And over the course of 50 years, those subtle differences in choice have created a society that in certain respects looks like ours, but in other fundamental respects doesn't. And one of the big questions for the next 20 years is, will China and India steer more in a European or more in an American direction? Right now, they're steering more in an American direction, especially in China, and that's very bad news.
Okay, let's take another question.
I have a nasty psychological question. It's not very long, but it's got three parts. It seems to me, arguably, this station is more responsible for global warming than any other. So, A, would you agree? B, if this is true, is this in the air? Do people sort of have some awareness of this? And then C, in terms of activism, should this be in the air?
The original question is, this nation is more responsible?
Yes,
there's no question that the U.S. is more responsible than any other for climate change. Sometime in the next year or so, the Chinese are going to surpass us in total emissions. But that doesn't mean very much. When that happens, the average Chinese person will still only be producing as much, you know, one quarter as much carbon as the rest of us. And person by person is the only way to logically think about this question. Otherwise, you could solve it just by splitting China into four countries, and that, you know, then there'd be no problem anymore. You know, it also, because of the residence time of carbon in the atmosphere, it'll be about 40 years before the Chinese, even at their current rates of growth, catch up to being as responsible as we are for climate change. The rest of the world is beginning to figure this out in more detail than they have in the past and beginning to be somewhat angrier about it. And I think that that anger will continue to grow, and it's especially going to grow if we not only don't do anything about it, but continue to behave in really irresponsible ways. The best example at the moment is our current plan to keep our, you know, driving our precise same vehicle fleet, but just doing it with corn instead of gasoline. You know, there were riots in Mexico City about a month ago because the price of tortillas had doubled. And the reason they doubled is because we put 80 new ethanol refineries online in Iowa in the last year and a half. If you haven't begun to plumb the depths of anti-American feeling, if that's what we decide to, you know, how we're going to proceed. You know, it's actually very interesting. The decline in America's standing in the world begins before the Iraq War and before any of that. Begins, and you can watch it on the polls almost like a needle on a. It begins the minute, the week that President Bush announces, and this is 6 weeks into his administration, that he's abrogating the Kyoto Treaty and isn't going to do anything about any of this. That's the moment at which public international sentiment about America just falls off the table, and it's never recovered since.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.